Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Well, I am so thankful to be sitting across from Mary Jo Sharp today. Hey, Mary Jo.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Although I have to admit, I thought that we were in the same time zone. I thought we were in the same city. I was thinking, wow, this will be fun. Maybe after COVID, we can get a cup of coffee. No, we cannot get a cup of coffee because even though I'm going to let Mary Jo introduce herself, but even though she does teach at Houston Baptist, she is on the other side of the country right now. So Mary Jo, tell us a little bit about that teaching and where you are.
Yeah, so I am an assistant professor of apologetics at Houston Baptist University, and I've been there for, this is my ninth year teaching.
Wow.
I helped to start the apologetics program at the university. And as of last year, my husband and I moved back to my hometown of Portland, Oregon to do a church revitalization.
That is so exciting. And I, you know, talked about how I thought Mary Beth was a Houstonian, but I actually came across her first from her book called Why I Still Believe. And I want to put the subtitle in here because I think that it is just provocative, but not without cause, right? So Why I Still Believe, a former atheist's reckoning with the bad reputation Christians give a good God. Is that right?
Yeah, way to go.
So I want to talk about that. But first, I was telling Mary Jo before we started recording, I really think that her social location is so interesting and important to her story. So you mentioned that you were in Portland, but then the bulk of this book takes place when you were living in Oklahoma and Texas, which is my stomping grounds. And so I just really thought, oh my goodness, in some ways, this could be my story. So can you tell us about just the book as a whole, and then we'll get into some of the really interesting parts about your story?
Yeah. So this book, by the way, was a book I did not want to write.
I can see that.
Yeah. It gets personal.
And, yeah, it does.
As an apologist, it was much happier for me to just argue arguments and let readers, or even listeners do whatever they wanted to do with it. So it was a book I didn't want to write because it's to take you into the mind of the apologist. Like what prompted me to search out this field where I'm trying to reason the faith and trying to figure out what I believe? What prompted me to do that? And a lot of that goes back to my experiences in the church. Having not grown up in church, I have childhood atheism in my background, and I grew up in a part of the country that is very post-Christian in its feel, very relativistic, postmodern feeling. And so I was saved in a Southern evangelical church in the Bible Belt in Oklahoma. And the book is about me being slammed into that culture shift and a lot of the problems that I experienced as I perceived that people were trying to make me a Southern evangelical woman instead of a follower of Christ. And there was a lot of hypocrisy that I dealt with along the way. So if I were going to say, like, what is this book really about? It's about me dealing with the problem of hypocrisy in the church. And then why I've come around to saying, yeah, I still believe in God. I didn't walk away. And so that's like the gist. What are we doing with this book? We're really trying to show, like, why didn't I deconvert and go back to my childhood atheism?
Right. So first, I feel like we should probably back up a step, because I'm thinking about, there was a point in my life, at a different point in my journey, where I would say, okay, apologetics. I'm almost there. I think I could put my finger on it. So can you define that field for us, and what you do when you say you even helped start the apologetics program? Tell us what that is in relationship to faith and Christianity, and then let's dive in a little bit more.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. That's so apologia is a Greek word that we just rip out of the Greek and we use it in the English language. We say apology, and you can find it in 1 Peter 3:15, in which Peter's encouraging a group of persecuted Christians to always be prepared to make a defense. There's your word, apologetic or apology, to make a defense of the reason of their hope. But to do so with gentleness and respect. So to anyone who asks of them. So he's telling them to make this defense of the reason of their hope. And that is the, you know, making the case for why do you believe in Jesus Christ as, you know, died for our sins and risen from the dead. So that's where this field comes from. Now, the way we do it in modern times is that we make a case for belief in God. These are the reasons why I think God is real and why I believe in him. But we also, in apologetics, this field of study, we're going to answer objections to belief in God. So as people say, you know, how can God be good when there's evil in the world, things like that. So it also answers those objections.
Yeah. So thank you for that. I just want to kind of make sure we're kind of on the same page when we're talking about this, because this is such a big part of your life now. But take us back to when you were in Portland before, when it was your hometown, because I mentioned to you before we started recording that I grew up in Oklahoma. I grew up in the buckle of the Bible Belt, as we used to say. Yeah. And so I have to admit, reading your story, the parts in Oklahoma rang ridiculously true for me, but the parts in Portland felt like a foreign world. Because when you even just now introducing yourself, this idea of childhood atheism, I have to say that struck me, because in Bible Belt America, I was trying to figure out how to word this. And I would say acknowledgement of God is the norm in Bible Belt America. I think maybe you would agree with that. But I would also specifically say growing up, because I didn't want to say Christianity is the norm in Bible Belt America, because I think that gets sticky, honest to goodness, I do. But I feel like acknowledgement of Jesus is the norm in Bible Belt America. So whether people are church going or not, whether their culture reflects a true faith in God or not, acknowledgement of Jesus and even Jesus as God in that central part of the country is very normal. So taking myself out of that context and trying to put myself in a context where as a child, that would not have been normal is very bizarre to me. You know, like we're like singing Jesus Loves Me in the car isn't like a normal thing. And I'm in Texas. A lot of my listeners are in Texas and they may have a similar experience. So take us back to Portland and this atheism that you grew up in.
Yeah. So my parents left the church. They were raised in church. They're Midwesterners. And they moved out to Portland because my dad was a brewmaster for Henry Weinhard's Private Reserve. So they were coming out in 1976 with a new label, and my dad was the one they wanted as assistant brewmaster.
Wow.
So that's how we are so Portland. Why we were there, my dad was doing craft brew right now.
Yes.
My dad and mom had left the church when I was very young, when we got out to the Northwest. And so I don't have really any memories of church. If you ask my brother and sister, they might have some, but what I did get instead, so they left the church. There's some hurt there. My dad, I think there may have been some disbelief there, but instead what I got in my life was that I had a father who was very interested in nature. He was very scientific minded. He's a chemical engineer, and he loved Carl Sagan, who is a science popularizer, who's also atheist. And he was like reading everything Carl Sagan. And we watched so much, so many of the science shows. And So my, and they were both, both my parents were both artistic and loved music and the, you know, opera and museums. So like my childhood was rich in culture, but no Christian culture, right? You might argue, well, it was influenced by a culture in America that was based in a Judeo-Christian ethic. And I would agree with that. But generally speaking, I didn't have near what you're talking about with the Bible Belt, where people actually, you know, talked about Jesus or at least recognized that the church was something that people did and it was part of their lives. And even if they didn't go, I just didn't have that. I spent my weekends camping up and down the Pacific Northwest. I spent my Sunday nights watching whatever operas or PBS or, you know, nature shows happened to be on. My mom sent me, she was a huge supporter of labor union. She sent me to labor union camp as a teenager to learn how to mediate between corporations and workers.
Wow. Like,
so when I say that,
that's awesome.
Very, very different. Just didn't, you know, if you had asked me, Mary Jo, are you saved? So like you were a Christian and you said, Mary Jo, are you saved? I would have said, honestly, saved from what? I wouldn't have known what you were talking about.
Would you have even known that language?
Right. So yeah. the only Christianity that I really knew, where I had a few friends that were Christians, but in the Northwest, we just, religion's very private and people just don't talk about it with, you know, openly, like I felt like they did in the South all the time. And then the other thing I saw was Christianity was what I saw in the movies and on TV. And quite honestly, a lot of my Christianity came from horror movies.
Oh, wow.
You know, like The Exorcist.
I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, for sure. Now it's making sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So I can put all of that in the book. You just have to, you know, choose what you're going to put. But that's kind of the background is Christianity seemed to me to be something that people did when they needed it. Mm-hmm. It seemed to be family related or background related, but I didn't need it. I didn't know what it was for. I had one boyfriend that dragged me off to church and I slept through all the services. I mean, I had blood sugar problems I didn't know about, so that's kind of my upbringing. I learned to wonder at the universe. I learned to appreciate the arts and what humans could do through that. I learned that there was great beauty and good in the world, but I did not have a Christian foundation for that.
Right. Okay. So this is like, I really want, we will come back to that because your chapter on beauty was like, it slayed me. I was completely done. So, but I don't want to jump too far ahead. So what prompted your move to Oklahoma? Because this is, I mean, I say this in the kindest way, family in Oklahoma, I love you so much, but it's like, this is not, it's kind of like Oklahoma. What's there, right? For people who are especially not in that part of the country, it's like, I don't even know. Like it's, there's not any big cities. There's not any, you know, like, so what prompted you to move there? And then I guess if you can wrap in your salvation experience and the culture shock, I'm assuming was present when you moved. So what prompted that? And then what was it like when you got there?
Yeah. Okay. So in high school, in my later years, I started to understand, sorry, my voice is breaking up a little bit. In my later years, I started to understand that, I had questions about why I believed in, you know, things like good and evil. And what was all this amazing music I was making? What was that for? Well, I had a high school band director who was a Christian who hadn't shared his faith with anybody. And he was burdened for me. Wow. So he was praying a lot about me. And, you know, as a public school teacher in this part of the country, he was terrified of sharing his faith with
me.
He felt like he would lose his job. Mm-hmm. So he took a risk with me my senior year and said, when you go off to college, you're going to have hard questions. And he said, I hope you'll turn to this. And he gave me a Bible my senior year of high school as like a going away gift.
Wow.
So apparently I have even forgotten this part. He reminded me that he prayed with me.
Wow.
And I didn't have like a favorable reaction. He actually thought I was going to turn him into the principal, but I wasn't mean, mm-hmm. But anyway, so I really respected because I was going to go off to college to get a music education degree.
Wow.
So that I could teach students to love music the way he taught us to love music. Mm. And that was my plan. So, he gives me that Bible. He hits me at the time when I'm thinking and wondering, is this all there is in the world? You know, I live and die and that's it. And ultimately my life has no real significance that lasts beyond my relative experience in this world. I wouldn't have framed it that well, but I was thinking these things. So he hit me at that time and I started reading that Bible. So he has a friend at the University of Oregon who is the head of the band program. He used to come out and train us. Like he would work with our high school band on our music. That gentleman moved to the University of Oklahoma to create their music ed program, like not to create it, but to develop it further and make it more of a national program that had arms across the United States. So he recruited me to go to the University of Oklahoma. And I wanted to teach like him. I wanted to teach like my band director. So I followed him because he was no longer at the University of Oregon. And I get to Oklahoma. My first reaction is, oh my gosh, where are the mountains and trees?
Yes. Okay. I have to stop you there because my husband's from Colorado. So I grew up in Southern Oklahoma, but we actually met at the University of Oklahoma. So I did my undergrad and my master's work there. And my husband did his master's and his PhD there. And so he came in, I was just telling my kids a story the other day. So I transferred to OU, even though I'd grown up in Oklahoma, I went to Texas for a couple of years. And so I transferred my junior year, which was my husband's first year of his master's. And he had grown up in Oklahoma. He went to, did his undergrad in Colorado, and he is a geologist whose mantra about his job is a bad day in the field is better than a good day in the office. And so when he came to Oklahoma, he had the exact same reaction, which was where are they? Where's the nature? Where are the rocks? Where are the mountains? Yes. And so you're not alone. I'm so sorry. I didn't know any different. So I just thought there are mountains. He's like, no, Arbuckle's in the South. He's like, I'm so sorry, but that doesn't count. So anyway, I just wanted to say, you're not alone. Yeah. So you're in Oklahoma, your first reaction is, oh dear, it's very flat.
Yeah. By the way, for your husband, there are some really cool geological structures in the Arbuckle Mountains.
Yes. And he has studied some of those. And as you get a little further down, like close to Arkansas, he did some of his field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. Like,
but where are the mountains?
That was my first, the university itself has an endowment, I believe, for its grounds. So it's really beautiful.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah.
You know, the west side of Oklahoma, you can see the whole Dust Bowl Grapes of Wrath going on there.
Yes.
You can see how that happened. Yeah. I get out to Oklahoma and I was very nervous because we came out I-40, which it's a long path of nothingness, like desert. And I shouldn't say that. There's people that live there and they're probably like, that's just not nice, but it is just so flat compared to growing up.
It's very flat. Yes. Yeah.
So I get there and, first of all, there are a lot of things I noticed. One was that as I got more comfortable with going to church and talking a little bit, I started going to church on my own for the first time to say like, hey, this Bible's starting to ring true to me. Maybe I need to go check some more things out. Like it seemed like God exists and I had kind of come around to that point. So I wanted to go check it out. I started checking out university churches in the area. And I noticed that people in Oklahoma were a whole lot more comfortable about talking about Jesus in particular. And everybody met seemed to be either at church, their dad was a preacher, they know somebody who was a preacher or something like that. I mean, it was just really different. I will also say for just as part of the culture shock, I couldn't find all the mom and pop coffee shops that I was
used to. Yeah. It's getting better. Like,
what? Where are they? And Starbucks is not a mom and pop shop.
and Starbucks took a minute to get to Oklahoma. I'm just going to tell you.
It did.
Yeah.
It took a hot minute because it was not there when I got there. Anyway, so it was very much just, it was also a slower lifestyle than I was used to, a little slower pace. The people talked more slowly and there's nothing wrong with that. My husband does that. In fact, they'll say like, I talk too fast. It took me a while in speaking to, calm myself down and not speak so quickly, but lots of things just very different. It felt a little time warped backwards from where I came. And even when I look at what my husband was wearing at the same time, like I'll look at his 1990 photos and my 1990 photos. And I look a little more, like the punk rock and stuff and the disaffected youth in Nirvana. And he looks a little more 1980s cool like polo pop shirts with feathered hair. And I was like, in the 90s? What's going on here?
Yes.
But he has to, now he's from a teeny tiny town. He's from Frederick, Oklahoma.
Okay.
He's from a very small town. And I'm from Portland. So I tease for anybody, I don't know that your listeners would know this, but Green Acres, if you know the old show.
Yes.
I'm not quite the big city Ava Gabor. I'm more of the disaffected Nirvana grunge ska band person.
But when the worlds meet.
Yeah, now I'm at this tiny little town guy, you know, with a popped collar and feathered hair. And
I love it.
Two worlds collide. I don't know that I really explained the culture shock, but there you go. There's some.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of the more superficial ones.
No, but I think it's, but I think that's important. You know, as part of the reason I bring that up, I think that's important because, you know, like I said, I grew up where that was the culture is people just talked about Jesus. I didn't know that, you know, things just feel a certain way from where you're from. And you just think that that's normal. And so when you go to the next place, then it is striking. So when you started kind of going to church on your own, I want to ask you specifically about your salvation experience, when did even the language start to become more familiar to you? Because there is kind of, I mean, if we're talking about the aspect of Christianity that can be hypocritical, there is included in that, I think, this kind of accusation of like Christianese, right? Where it's like, you're talking a different language. And you alluded to that before, like if someone asked you, were you saved, would you even have known what that meant? So when did you start to become even more familiar with, I would say maybe Bible Belt Christian culture, but the culture where you would be able to recognize, you know, just even the terms or just becoming familiar that this was something that people did. They just talk about Jesus or they talk about church or their dad's a pastor. And that's very, very common. What about that led up to your salvation experience?
Yeah, so I'm going to church on my own freshman in college. And so I'm the anti-statistic. I'm actually searching for faith.
Right.
I don't know if that's a real word, but, I've been reading in the Bible, a lot. So that's where I'm starting to get the language of Christianity is from what I'm reading in the Bible. I also met my backslidden Christian husband in my freshman year.
Okay.
And so he's really like, wow, this is so different when he met me because I was a spiky haired, no makeup wearing Portlander. And he just was taken with me because I wasn't Southern. So he was the one that as we got together and as we became serious and became engaged and my book even alludes to the fact that I had a baby while I was still in college, while we were still very young. He was the one that said, I'm serious about this. I'm serious about being a family man and I need to take her to church.
Wow.
So that was sort of like solidifying that I was going to go to church. So I'd been doing it on my own, but not real formally, not real committed. And then when I met my husband and we got engaged and this all happened pretty fast. He was the one that said, no, I need to take her to church. And it was at that church which we were invited to by his ex-girlfriend. Awesome. She's great. But I thought it was crazy. I got to throw that in there. And that was where I actually heard somebody present the gospel in just a very clear, like, this is why you need a savior. And I had been studying on my own for a while. And so that had been ringing true to me, but I hadn't heard it put into a way that I could understand it. So that pastor actually came out to our apartment and talked to me, you know, about, he did like the evangelism explosion question. So for anybody who was trained in that, he's, you know, if you die tonight, would you go to heaven? And I was very logical. And matter of fact, no, I would not. If I were standing before God, I would say, yeah, you shouldn't let me into heaven because I haven't trusted your son from, you know, for my salvation. And he was like, what? All right. This is not the answer we normally get. People normally say,
like, textbook.
Yeah. People normally say like, I'm a good person. So
right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I was like, no. I see it in there is that I need to trust Jesus. And if I don't trust Jesus, then I don't have salvation in him. So like that was the moment at which I became a believer. It wasn't very emotional. My husband was emotional because he had realized how backslidden he had become. And so now he was convicted, but I was more like, yep, I'm ready to do this now.
Nice. But don't you think that again, I just keep thinking about the culture, because in Pacific Northwest culture and then Bible Belt culture, it's like, what about that? You know, I mean, this is totally a question for your husband, but it's like, what about that is like, okay, I need to be a family man. And that equals in some way raising my family in a church where you're going, I mean, I'm putting words in your mouth, but it's like my parents were family people and we were raised going camping and listening to opera. And, you know, it's like, there's not, you know, there is something about that cultural experience in the middle part of the country that says when you have a family, this is what you do. You go to church. Even you alluded to it when you said you're the anti-statistic of going to college and looking for faith. One of the things that I grew up hearing and understanding was that a lot of people lost their faith when they went to college, but they kind of get it back once they get married and have kids, right? Like they, you know, because they just realize exactly what your husband had said, that they would need to raise their kids in church. So I don't know, are you comfortable telling the story of how you open the book with you going ready to profess your faith at church and what happened? Because if we're talking about the hypocrisy, I mean, it's so hard. I don't want to go into this, and I know you don't either, with just like, let's just spill the beans. Let's just talk about this as if it's nothing, because it's not. But I think it's important for us to talk about that. So tell the story of when you went to church ready and excited to share your profession of faith with the congregation and what happened that morning.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I appreciate your sensitivity to the fact that we're not just church bashing, that there is an end to this. And as we talk, we may get to that point where you see that I felt like I brought a lot of naivety with me into the church. But that first day, so yes, I'm this Pacific Northwesterner. I'm a poor college student. I'm young, married, and I have a baby. Lots of stress, lots of worry about what people think of me. And so back home, what do people think of me? Because here I am about to go into a Southern Baptist church and accept Jesus. And I didn't know if they'd think I was brainwashed by the Bible Belt or what they would think. And then I didn't know what this new culture would think of me, this Southern evangelical culture, because here I am coming in as this young, you know, mother and still in college. So that first day I'm an emotional mess. So I tend to be overcompensating. I'm an introvert, but when I'm nervous, I become this like overcompensating extrovert. And as I'm walking up to the sanctuary door with my husband, the pastor's wife is standing there greeting people and she's smiling. And I'm expecting something like, "Hey, I heard you got saved. I'm so excited for you. That's a big commitment, you know, like, yay." And then as we approach her, her smile drops and she gives me the once over. So for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, that's a Southern thing. And she's checking out my outfit. And as we approach her, the first words out of her mouth were, "Oh, honey, we need to find you better clothing." Right? That's the very first thing. I had two dresses in my closet by that point in my life. And I passed it by my husband, said which one is appropriate for church. And, you know, he's like, "You look great. This is awesome." And the first thing that I get after I become a new believer and I'm about to go walk the aisle,
right?
That's what you do in evangelical churches. You walk up the middle of the church and you go up to the pastor and profess your belief in God before they turn you around before everybody and welcome you as a new believer. And I've been told I'm inappropriately dressed. Mm-hmm. So that's very confusing to a person who's looking for acceptance and is excited about their newfound faith in God. And it seems to be focused on the wrong thing. So as a new believer, I didn't know how to process that. I didn't know how to put words to it. I was just a little bit confused, angry, and embarrassed. Now that I'm older, I just know it was very wrong. It was very wrong to do that to a new believer in a different culture.
Right. I mean, I do feel like I don't want to minimize your overall experience, but one of the things that I really felt like I gleaned from your book, and I think it has to do with you not growing up in this church culture, is that I don't want to say that, how to phrase this? I don't want to say that you experienced less shame, because I don't want to minimize the actions that they did that hurt, because those actions were not okay. But having grown up similarly, at least in this culture, I felt like there was something in you that isn't in a lot of people that grow up in that culture that immediately knew this was not okay. And I kind of want to point that out, because I feel like, and this isn't the fault of someone or whatever, like I said, I want to be super sensitive, but I'll talk about my personal experience and just say, when this is all you know, it's all you know. And you just kind of take that, right? And so there was a little bit of that with Roger, right? So tell us about your response, kind of not versus necessarily, but in comparison to his response after that interaction with the pastor's wife that morning.
Yeah. So my response is, I got hit like a ton of bricks.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that. His response is, oh, okay, we'll take care of it. Thank you. So like, he just wanted to placate it and move along. And when I was writing the book, I asked him, I was like, did you really say that? And he's like, yeah, that's really what I said. Like, oh, okay, I'll take care of it. And I said, wow. So he just went, okay, whatever. This is the way things are in the church. I immediately felt a sense of this is not right. And that's based on me reading through the New Testament and continuing my own education on my own, and versus what I was seeing when I first came into a church.
Right. So that's what was another thing that was so awesome to me about your book and so striking, was that you immediately recognized the incongruence. You immediately recognized it, but that didn't come from a specific other Christian upbringing. That came from, you just said, reading the New Testament.
Yeah.
Like
there's no condemnation in Christ, right? Paul. And, and the first thing I get is condemnation and judgment.
Can you unpack that just a little bit more? Like, can you just sit there for a minute?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that was very attractive to me about Christianity. It was the teachings of Paul, was Jesus's teachings, you know, about how the world's going to know that we are his followers by the great love that we have for one another. You got Jesus praying in the Garden of Gethsemane that we would be one, so that the world would know he's God's son. Like, this is so important in Christianity, that God himself praying in the garden, God incarnate, is saying, please let them be one, so that they will testify to the world that I am the Son of God. Like, that's nothing to sneeze at. It's not something to pass by lightly, or to say, well, that's not how I was raised, right? This is something that's really important. And to me, it was vital. I expected to find people in the church who were committed to that lifestyle, that they might fail in it, but that they would recognize their failure and be repentant and be the kind of people who are constantly striving for unity, constantly striving for that love of one another, that they were the ones that would be patient, slow to anger, that they would really feel convicted if they were gossips or slanderers, and that they would be the kind of people that come to each other and say, I can't live like this. Like, I can't live like this and say that I follow Jesus. And over and over, it wasn't just in the beginning. It was just constant. As we got into ministry, it got heightened, right? I would see so many times of pastors or church leaders or church members who, for them, self-preservation of, you know, their position or their power or whatever it was so much more important than the teachings of the apostles or of Jesus himself. And, you know, I was like, wow, what that did to me. And I'll sort of wrap it up here. What that did to me over the first decade, actually it was before the first decade of my Christianity, was I started to think, these people don't really believe this. They're not conforming their lives to it. They're doubling down in their vices. These are patterns of behaviors. This is a social club. It is not, I was not seeing in my own experience. Now I'm not talking about the whole of Christendom or everyone's experience, but in my experience, I was not seeing that this was real to them and that they took it so seriously as to conform their lives to it.
I'm just enamored with that because it's this Ephesians 3 prayer, like every day, like God root me and ground me in your love. Right. And it's just like, I feel like I can see those roots in your life where instead of just saying, well, I guess this is the way it is. It was like, no, like there was a deep recognition that following Jesus did not jive with what you were experiencing in this culture of Christianity that you were experiencing. And I think it's just, I just think it's really amazing that you pursued that. But I don't want to make it sound so easy because because it's not like, oh, that was it. She knew it was wrong and different. And now you're an apologetics professor and everything is great. I mean, that'd be tidy in a 22-minute sitcom, but tell us a little bit about, tell us as much as you want to about this process of yours where you, I don't know, could you feel yourself on the path to deconversion? Could you feel yourself going there? And what was that tension like? And what were some of the things you were doing to kind of pursue that tension and that fight?
Yeah. This is a really hard question because even today I'm still working through all of the psychology of it, what was going on back then. And, you know, there's feelings of being like, I didn't even include this in the book. I'm sure I was feeling trapped that, you know, I was in the South and I was never getting back to where I was from. I'm sure that was part of it too. And I didn't even include that in the writings, but I know that, this was really tough for me because I felt bamboozled. And I use that a lot with people. I'm like, oh, so when sometimes I read deconversion stories, I'm like, oh, they've got the bamboozlement going on. Like that's their argument. They feel like they got into something and that they were tricked, either from childhood, because they trusted in their parents and other authorities. And then they get out of the, you know, they start getting the rational thought in their early preteen years. And then they start going, wait a minute, these people don't really believe this stuff because they're not acting like it. And they get that bamboozlement feeling too. And I think that was part of it. So there's the, you know, I'm in a culture I don't fit in. There's this, wait a minute, I don't see these people really living it out. So maybe I made a mistake because I actually like my atheist and agnostic friends from the Portland area. They're like nicer people in general. So that was going on. There was also my husband, by the point that I'm saying, I wonder if this is really true because I'm not seeing it lived out. And in my own life too, like I'm not taking it full on. It's not my whole life's not conforming to Christ or anything like that. So I'm trying to figure out this mess. And I'm at this time, my husband's a minister. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I just can't come out and say, hey, I'm not sure if this is real because he would have to give up his job. So I also have a mess of desire going on. There's, I don't know if I want it to be true anymore because I don't like it. I don't like the people in it. I don't like the community and I'm very much hurt over and over. So there's that desire. I don't know that I was aware that the desire in me was growing to like hope that it wasn't true so that I could walk away. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a tough one for people who are dealing with that feeling of bamboozlement. I think you can slip into desiring it to not be true, whether like not even considering that it might still be true, even if everybody around you is a hypocrite. But that feeling was growing in me that, maybe I could just walk away. If I could prove it was wrong, if I could prove that this is just false, if it's all false, then maybe I could walk away from it. So I started looking for, well, why do I say I believe in God? How do I know that these things are true? Why do I say Jesus rose from the dead? And I realized I had no answers to that, no answers, and nothing that would separate me out from any other religious belief, for sure. So like for a Mormon, you know, to say, I only had like a testimony. I could say, well, I know in my heart, you know, or just nothing that would separate why I chose this versus anything else. So that really started me on the path towards, I got to find answers. And for some reason, I put in the book a little memoir of when my daughter was born, and I walked, you know, when she was born, I walked out into this, I was going to take her home from the hospital, and I walk out into this cloud of smoke, cigarette smoke. And I think, ew, this is so disgusting. And I look over to see where it's coming from, and it's doctors and nurses. And I said, man, what a bunch of hypocrites. These guys, like, they absolutely tell me, don't smoke, it'll kill you. They have professed that with their whole career is about saving people's lives. And yet they're out here killing themselves with smoking. And then that memory sort of like is what I relate my journey to, which is that, oh, right. People can profess something as true and absolutely believe it and still choose to live in rebellion to it. And that's what I was seeing over and over again in the church. Now, I won't say that that was, you know, 100% across the board, but I do think there are Christians that absolutely believe in God. They believe in Jesus Christ. They, you know, they trust him for their salvation, but they are choosing, you know, lifestyles of rebellion. And I was experiencing a lot of that, you know, where my vice is okay. I can double down into my vice and I could be a gossip or a slanderer and that's okay because I'm saved, you know, but, or in spite of being saved, it's just, I didn't realize at a very deep level, like human psychology or this idea of the sinner saint. I didn't have very good education, Christian education, and deeply reflecting on the problem of evil and how that would affect my church experience. That was a lot, but there a lot of stuff that packed into that. And, you know, I had to really deal with, do I even want this to be true? And what do you do with that?
I feel like that came out some in your response to when you started listening to the atheists debating, right? Like there's a part or two where you say, I know when I listen to him that he is going to be really profound. He's going to be a great, you know, arguer. He is going to have these fantastic points. And so ready, set, play, you know, go. And that wasn't always what you experienced when you listened to those debates, but that is almost an aside because what I felt like I gleaned from that is you're in this and you're going, I don't know if I ask God, search me and know me, would he say, you don't want this to be true? But even then he is big enough and grand enough and secure enough for all of our questions in that space, right? So even for those of us who are going, I probably won't ever watch a Christian debate. I have no interest in what you call apologetics or whatever, yeah. but we are questioning people. So can you just, I just was really hoping that you could just tell us a little bit about that from like your heart experience and what makes God and his relationship with us unique in that we can question him and it's okay.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the more that I study, God, and then the more I spend time in my relationship with God, I begin to realize that he made me a creature who has rationality and part of, you know, an emotion and, you know, desire. And part of that, having that gift of rationality is that I can question things. And actually that's not a bad thing. As you read through your New Testament, especially Apostle Paul, he's in your corner. If you're a questioner, he is right there with you. He says that the Bereans in Acts 17, when he preached to the Bereans, Luke's reporting that he's saying they were of more noble character because they checked out what he was saying. Like they actually checked it out to see if what he was teaching was true. He's not excusing his own teaching from us investigating and seeing if that's true. And then 1 Thessalonians 5:21, Paul tells us, test everything and hold on to the good. And he's referencing what you're hearing in church because that's the context, is prophecy in the church. So God has made us in a way in which we are creatures who question. That's how we learn. That's how we grow. It's part of who we are, made in his image. And he wants us to be engaged with him in conversation. He wants us to be people who grow in maturity in our knowledge of God and conformity to Christ. And, you know, this life of discovering who it is we profess and just deeply knowing our God. This is all part of, you know, getting to know him and building our relationship with him. And so for me, apologetics, what it does for me, this defense of the faith, which sounds very like, oh, that's argumentative. And you're not supposed to be argumentative, by the way. But what it does for me is that it helps me to know my God better. And if I want to get to know you, Alexis, we're going to have to hang out and I'm going to have to find out about you. And I'm going to actually have to do research and study you. Those are weird words to use when you're talking about your friend, but that's what you're doing. What kind of music do you like? Where do you, what's your favorite coffee? You know, those kind of things where I'm learning about you and growing in my knowledge of you. And in that way, because you are a person and I'm a person, that's how you and I grow in our relationship. Well, God is also a being with personhood. So as I learn about him, as I communicate with him, as I study him, he becomes more real to me. Like, yeah, he is a person. And I can, you know, either learn to distrust him or I can learn to trust him. I can learn about him or I can grow distant from him, just like I can with people. And I think that's what apologetics really just drove home for me. Is making God very real in my life and then means starting to understand who he is, that he has personhood. And that played a big part of my distrust of God was that I began distrusting people. So that transferred over to distrusting God who also has personhood.
Yes, I love that part where you talk about having trouble trusting God because he's a real person. And it's like, this is a real relationship. And so you realize he's going to reveal some things to you about himself and maybe not others. And it was, you know, just this, like, really this reality of relationship, even though he is divine, he does have personhood and he relates to us. So thank you for expanding on that a bit. I'm hoping maybe we can wrap up kind of back a little bit when I kind of teased and said, I want to get here. I feel like now we need to go there. The beauty, because you're talking about getting to know God more. And your chapter on beauty wrecked me. And so I would just say, take anything from that realm, from that space that you think might be relevant to this conversation or you feel God leading or to our listeners or whatever, but can you just talk about the beauty of God and that part of your experience?
Yeah. I will tell the listeners that this is newer for me. So I want to encourage them to go well beyond anything that I say with this. My experience in the church was that the church was really good at discussing the goodness of God. And so there's a lot of issues on morality in the church. And we're also very good about discussing the truth of God so that God is real. And, you know, a lot of what I deal with in apologetics has to deal with that. But we've sort of just completely forgotten about the beauty of God. So these three transcendentals of God, the goodness, truth, and beauty of God. And there, you know, there's historical reasons why we've left that. And I'm not going to go into those because that deals with the Reformation and all sorts of stuff. But for me, I was so drawn to God by the beauty that I saw in the world that he made and in the cosmos. I mean, my dad just loving outer space. And that's, I mean, Carl Sagan, he has a book called Cosmos. So I just saw great beauty in the world. And as I'm coming to God, like as I'm questioning, well, what is this all for? One of the things I found in the Bible is that God is our source of beauty because he himself is objectively beautiful. There is no teaching that I received in the church on that at all. What I received instead was that beauty was dangerous. Beauty was linked to lust. so that I began to distrust beautiful women. I began to distrust things like looking beautiful or performing. Like I'm very moved by the performing arts. So I tried to bring that into the church, and it was always met with this distrust. Why do we have dancers on the stage? Why are they in dance uniforms? You know, things like that. And for me, it was very disheartening, because one of the main things that drew me into God was constantly being pushed back against and being told that it was evil. I was being told basically that it was evil. So I didn't know what to do with beauty. And I think that affects a lot of people in the church today. I don't think that leaders in the church are doing this intentionally. I think they're doing it out of trying to protect, you know, people from lust, from the, you know, maybe the pornography issue that's so rampant in the church today. But at the same time, they're not balancing it with what do we do with beauty? If there's a beautiful person in your church, I watch this time and time again of beautiful women, powerful, intelligent women being marginalized in the church just because they were beautiful and smart. And you know, what are you teaching people about? What is the purpose of that? And one of the things that I've come to, and what I concluded in chapter 9, was shouldn't the beauty that we see in the world, including humans, if you find somebody attractive or beautiful, shouldn't that point you back to the beauty of God himself? Shouldn't that be a testimony that God is creative and that he himself is beautiful? So that's kind of where I came to, is that for me, I am to appreciate beauty in the world, no matter where I see it, because it reflects my creator, just like goodness and truth do. And that was what I think you're talking about in chapter 9, which is that, and I haven't gotten a lot further along, just because I do a lot of teaching and I'm in other areas, but this is something like I would recommend Roger Scruton and his works on this. What is beauty for, and what are we supposed to do with it? What is it supposed to point us to? So it's not, we shouldn't just view beauty with a skeptical eye in the church, but we should teach what it's for and then what to do with it.
Thank you. I was finishing your book up when we happened to be on a beach vacation. We just got to get away for the weekend. And we were out, and there was actually a tropical storm like on the horizon. It's going to be coming in the next day or two. And we're just looking out at the waves and the sand and the birds. And of course, you know, even reminiscing, you know, my husband coming and going, where are the mountains? And, you know, all of this, but it's just like, creation is so beautiful. And I just kind of stopped. And for me, it was one of those, like, I don't know anybody who would say this is not beautiful. And it helped me kind of begin to think about beauty as being objective, because it's an aspect of God. And so thank you for that part of your book, and for kind of elaborating on that, because it's something that I've been mulling over, and it just makes me smile. It's just like it's a really wonderful, like, heartwarming thought of just thinking that God puts his own beauty inside of us and inside of creation as a way to point back to him. So Mary Jo, what we've covered so much today, but what would you like to leave us with that you feel either we haven't talked about or need to be reiterated as we close out?
Yeah, I would, thank you for asking that. I would definitely say that I'm hoping that the people who are listening understand that the hypocrisy of the individual believers cannot negate or be the litmus test. Let's say the hypocrisy of the believers can't be the litmus test for the truth of Christianity. God has left us so many evidences of his goodness. We have the historical event of Jesus's resurrection to show us who he is and how much we mean to him and how much we are valued and loved. And so just to keep in mind that Christianity is a testable faith. It's evident, you know, it has lots of evidence, but that there's also so much beauty and goodness and truth to be found there. That don't just let the behaviors of the Christians around you be that test for you. Look into it for yourself and see what you find.
Thank you so much. And Mary Jo, where can we find you on the web, on social media, and where can we find your book?
Thank you. My website is maryjosharp.com. And then you can find my book, Why I Still Believe, on amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or christianbook.com, pretty much wherever they sell Christian books.
Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story.
Thank you so much for having me.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.